Hi, it's Simon Smart here. Good to be with you. Scott Stevens grew up in America, in the very place the first season of True Detective was filmed. And he says the show gets it right. The gothic, sinister vibe of the show, as well as the beautiful cinematography, are, he says, all accurate depictions of that part of the US. So his childhood was rather unique. Also, his dad was a staunch Republican and his mum a kind of peacenik Democrat. But they loved each other and were devoted to their family. His dad was a hard man who taught him self-reliance, while his mum taught him to love art and literature. But they both taught him that it was important to live as if he was standing before God with a clear conscience and pure soul. Scott's now the editor of ABC's Religion and Ethics website, and it's not hard to see that the rich tapestry of his early life led him right to this role. This is a conversation Justine and I had with Scott a little while back, and it's a fascinating exploration of Scott's early years. It's one of my favourite interviews at CPX. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Simon Smart.
Well, we're really happy to have as our guest in the studio today, Scott Stevens, our dear friend, who also is the editor of the ABC Religion and Ethics website and the co-presenter with Waleed Ali of Radio National's The Minefield. Now, if you've ever gone on the ABC Religion and Ethics website, you would know that it is absolutely chock full of fabulous content. But what you might not know is that Scott's backstory is also full of wonderful stories. And Scott, thank you for coming in.
It's nice to be here.
We know that you're an American and you were born and raised in Cincinnati, but have also spent time in New England, New Orleans, and it may strike people as surprising that you spent some time in the Solomon Islands. So why don't you kick us off by telling us where you grew up.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Cincinnati, which is really kind of good old-fashioned Middle Eastern of the U.S., industrial country. Cincinnati is quite a strange, largely industrial, quite poor city, but didn't spend a great deal of time there. We were only there for about 2 years, I think, while my father was working at the University of Cincinnati. Then we had a little bit of time in New England, a little bit of time in North Carolina. But then most of the time in the U.S. was actually spent in Louisiana. I don't know if anybody's sort of watched the first season of True Detective, but True Detective was shot where I grew up.
Get out. That is even more exciting than I thought.
Well, yes. Talk about a show that perfectly captured something of the... Well, there's actually something quite sort of gruesome about Louisiana. It's moist, it's flat, but it also represents this strange mixture of faith, of various forms of kind of strange religious syncretisms and immixtures, a tremendous amount of kind of inbred nepotism. I mean, really, just a very strange place. It seemed to me, you can tell I don't want to talk about my life. Let's talk about True Detective. I mean, that first season really captured, I think, the complexity of the place. But I think what this little itinerary around the U.S., and we then went from the Louisiana to the Solomon Islands, what that really reflects is my father's nomadic nature. I mean, we grew up effectively without a home.
Yeah, well, tell us about that, Scott. Mm. What was your family like, and what was family life like for you?
Well, I began life as the youngest of five children. My father's a professionally driven man, quite a brilliant mechanical engineer, quite a hard man as well in many ways. And yet, in the final portion of his doctoral studies, he ended up fostering six children as a single man. Then when he and my mother were married, they adopted four of them, which, I mean, already is actually quite remarkable. There's a sort of generosity there about him.
And you said he was a bit of a hard man. Tell us a bit more about him.
Yeah, I mean, good, in many respects, good Presbyterian stock. He's a true blue constitutional American. The Stevens go right back to the signers of the Constitution. So, you know, there's something kind of deeply and recognizably traditionalist about him. But I think one of the things that really always struck me is a fundamental lack of trust. He didn't trust institutions. He didn't trust governments. I mean, we often see that within American life. But what was interesting about my father is a lack of trust in any institution outside of family. There's something very individualistic about his relationship with God, for instance. He did not trust the church. He could not trust the church. He didn't trust public schools, would not trust public schools. So the strange thing, I suppose, that dominates kind of the first 15 years of my life was absolute isolation. There was our family and there was nothing else. My parents homeschooled me and much of the time didn't even use a recognizable curriculum. There was a real sense of protection. They wanted to shield their children from the insidious influences out there. And the best way of doing that was for the family to become our church, for the home to become school. Yeah, and it was a strange way, I suppose, to kind of grow up.
What was your mother like in the mix of this? Because you described your father as a hard man. Was your mother similarly hard as well?
My dad's very exacting, very demanding. One of the real problems with growing up in that kind of relationship is the line between father, son, parent, teacher became very blurred. I could never get math. I just could not understand math, and math is his world. He lives and breathes it. So he would get really angry at me when I couldn't understand things, and school discipline very quickly became kind of physical punishment. That's what I mean by him being a hard man. My mother, she resonates with me more than anybody else in this world. She was an anthropology major at Georgetown University. She was a VW driving hippie. My dad's a Republican. She's a Democrat. He was a Nixon man. She was a Kennedy man, a Kennedy woman. They were very, very different. They were bound together, though, in their devotion to their family and their deep, deep love for one another. But it often seemed to me that my mom's job was to nurture things that my father couldn't. I would even say encourage a kind of mysticism in us, encourage an openness to life and the world and literature and poetry. I mean, the things that she had me reading from the time I was very, very young to nurture this kind of rich and full openness to the experience of God was more important to me than anything else. So she was the opposite to him in many respects. She's very open and attentive, very aware. When she was with you, she is absolutely with you. One of these people that makes you feel as though that, you know, you're the center of the universe.
I have to admit, hearing you talk about this, that I can't get Terence Malick's The Tree of Life
yes.
out of my mind.
Yes.
You know, you've got your father, the disciplinarian, the way of nature, and you've got the mother, the way of grace.
You got that exactly right. That's one of the reasons I have a very hard time watching Tree of Life.
That seems almost, it's a very unexpected thing, that sort of openness to literature and other things that your mum brought you. When you started to talk about your dad and the sort of the family being the center of the whole thing and the extent of your life in some ways, those two things don't normally go together. Is that openness what saved you in some ways?
No. Strangely enough, I mean, my mom has given me more than I could ever repay, just in terms of nurturing things that have resonated deeply with my soul. I have to say, though, Simon, I owe my father the world. I mean, this sounds kind of bizarre and a little bit pathetic, but I'm a lifelong opponent of homeschooling. I mean, there's something about the socializing experience of school. There's something about this, you know, the school also being a school of friendship and in which you learn certain social capabilities and certain virtues.
Which you missed out.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm incredibly socially awkward. I stuttered. As a young man, I stuttered compulsively. But what my father did is he conveyed an unwavering sense of self-reliance. So he would give me a book and say, read the following 20 pages, do the exercises tonight, I'll check them in the morning, or I'll check them later that night. And what it meant, and this has actually set me in pretty good stead for the rest of my life, if I don't understand something, well, tough luck. You just keep reading and reading and reading and reading until you get it. So most things that I've ended up doing in my life, I've had the benefit of wonderful education, but most things that I've done have been on the back of being a bit of an autodidact. You just keep teaching yourself. So it's that reliance on oneself that he has probably gifted me with more than anything else. So, I mean, look, I have a tremendous affection for my father. He's a hard man, but a wonderful man. But it's that refusal to wait for anybody else to do it for you that's been really important to me.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Our guest is Scott Stevens, the editor of the ABC Religion and Ethics website, and he's telling us about his story. Scott, you mentioned before that your family went to the Solomon Islands because your father was nomadic and you didn't have a home. Talk us through how that happened, that your life was uprooted from the States and sent to the Pacific.
Yep. You made reference to The Tree of Life before. Let me make reference to another film. If you want to understand what happened when, at the height of his career, he was university professor of mechanical engineering at University of Southwestern Louisiana. He was one of the top robotics researchers and innovators in the United States, a man in extraordinary demand. And one day, in 1988, he picked up the family and he said, I think God wants us to go visit the Solomon Islands. And we flew over and we spent 2 weeks there, and it was strange and it was weird. It was a little bit wonderful. He came back, worked for another 18 months, and then we sold everything. Now, selling everything wasn't a big deal because he never took out a loan. All of his savings were in little gold coins in a tin box under the bed. He didn't trust banks either. Yep. Yes, exactly. But his great concern, the film I wanted to make reference to, is Mosquito Coast. Mm. He was convinced that America was teetering on the brink of catastrophe. That was one of the reasons he refused to ever have too many encumbering ties with institutions or banks or in anything else. So he was convinced that the Solomon Islands would be a safe haven for the family. So much of it was a kind of missionary desire to go, and he taught in a Church of Melanesia school there. He and my mother both taught there. But the great underlying motive was to pick up the family, to take them someplace safe so that they could weather the storm that was going to come.
And we should also mention that this is perhaps one of those stories that we can't tell, even though your whole backstory is full of these. Your father spent time with the CIA in biological warfare, and that, it sounds like, was also influencing his decision to sort of uproot the family?
It certainly fed into his paranoia. I mean, the stories that we heard growing up about who really killed JFK. He was there when it happened. So he was one of those very lucky, slightly upper class draftees who, instead of being shipped off as a grunt to Vietnam, he was drafted directly into the CIA to work in international intelligence, some espionage. But his main thing, his main area of research, was the way in which mosquitoes can be utilized for biological warfare.
Went somewhere where there's lots of mosquitoes, presumably.
Where mosquitoes are the predominant form of bird life, yeah.
Now, Scott, I want to ask you about the picture you received as a child of God. What was the character of God like for you as a kid growing up?
I've never been asked that question, Simon. Wonderful. It was complex. As a child, I had a massively hyperactive conscience. My parents never had to worry about catching me out in anything, because if I did something wrong, the clock was ticking and I would confess all. And that really did reflect my idea of God as well. Not just that I was afraid that God was looking over my shoulder and wanted to punish me. It was more, you want to live with clear conscience. You want to be able to stand before God with as clear a conscience and as pure a soul as one can. And I think that idea of purity was always a very, very important one growing up. In a sinful age, we needed to keep ourselves pure. The other side of it was, it's not just that God wants us to be pure. But it's also, there was a deep sense of vocation, that God wants us to be a particular way because he's calling us to do a particular thing. I was never frightened. God was never a fearful image for me, despite whatever kind of fear I might have had from my father. But it was more a great desire to please, maybe an overactive desire to please. Looking back, I probably had nothing like a robust enough understanding of grace and mercy. But what it did provide was a tremendous sense of vocation, that we are in this world called to do something. And so, I mean, if there's one verse that summed up my entire childhood, you are not your own. You are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God with your body. So that really probably reflects just about everything there was to know for me about, you know, what it meant to live in a universe superintended by God.
It's a temptation not to pop psychologize it and say that, you know, your father created a portrait of a particular kind of God and then you were swept up by the God of grace. That's to impose too neat a frame over it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Because I've never seen the availability of mercy. I've never seen the tremendous comfort of grace as being in some way opposed to or relief from the exacting God. I mean, you know, this really goes back to a very Christian understanding for me of what freedom is. I mean, freedom isn't the ability to do what one wants. Freedom is the ability to do what is best. Freedom, in its deepest Christian sense, is the inability to sin. And so I think for me, you know, what I suppose I always yearned for, what I always pursued, was the ability to be holy without knowing that I was holy. And that really reflects the sort of stuff that my mom gave us to read. People like Archbishop Fenelon, people like Madame Guyon, like Oswald Chambers, like A.W. Tozer. Oh my gosh, I haven't thought about these names for ages. I mean, there's something about what they taught that, yes, God wants purity, but he doesn't want purity that knows that it's pure. He wants purity that's so caught up with the goodness and the grace of God that it simply gets about doing the task that's been set before it. So, you know, I know that sort of in popular culture today, we see these things as being dramatically opposed. There's either forgiveness or there's, you know, heavy restrictions. I don't see them. I've never seen them as being opposed. Rather, grace is that wonderful gift that gives us the ability to be what God wants us to be.
From the Center for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. This is actually only the first half of our conversation with Scott Stevens. Head over to our website, publicchristianity.org, to listen to part two of our conversation. Here's a sneak peek.
It was simply being a kind of umpire, being a sort of traffic cop for the ABC's already existing religion content, kind of one-stop shop if you wanted to read everything that the ABC had to say about religion.